through Friday at 8 a.m. without commercial interruption, thanks to listeners just like you. It's 9 o'clock here in New York, and coming up next is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. You know, sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree, with a joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry. And then you're bound to see my other side. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Get more than my share, but that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you.
Good morning.
Good morning, and good morning to you too. This is Gloria J. Brown Marshall, and this is Law of the Land, a program that's designed to inform, to empower, to inspire, to help you to think about how you can use the power you have to make the world a better place. Not just wait for someone else to do it, but within your sphere of influence, that wingspan you have, to say that I'm going to make this choice over that one. I am going to go out of my way just a little bit. And in doing so, you have started that ripple in the water that is going to affect people well beyond your knowledge. My feeling is, and this is what's come from working on books that look over time, hundreds of years, that those who did not take their choice to act based on whether or not they knew exactly who would be the beneficiary. Think about that. I'm here because people who never knew my name said that they are going to help in the civil rights movement or in education. They're going to speak up for women and girls. They are going to make sure the world is a better place, that food is edible and doesn't have poison in it, that medicine is available. I remember Dr. Waxman, he and his wife, and they had a trailer. These were back in the day when they were like, I guess they figured that, you know, these Dr. Waxman, Mr. Dr. and Dr. Waxman, husband and wife, wife and husband, partners, went into the communities as a Jewish couple, and they went into communities of color to give their health services. When I was a kid, I remember Drs. Waxman. I remember them coming into the communities. And I remember the librarian, for example, who, even though this was not legal segregation, but the country was still segregated, made sure that we had certain books to read. I remember these things. And so even though they might not ever remember my name in particular, they might not have done this for me as an individual person, what they did helped me. It helped me go beyond anything that I probably would have been able to do. If I didn't have those books in the library, then I read each and every one of them I could put my hands on and always tried to get that gold star at the end of the summer for having read the most library books. I remember these things, and I also remember the racism I had is with teachers who, even though we didn't have racial segregation, divided my grade school class up by race. I remember that. I remember these things. And so you remember the people who helped. You also remember those who hindered. And I tell the story of how I worked on my post-college applications. I was graduating and I wanted to know, am I going to be a writer? Am I going to be a lawyer? Am I going to business school? I didn't know. The world was open to me and I was unsure what path to take after college. But I just knew I wanted to get out of college. I was really tired of the University of Missouri Columbia. So I decided that I would apply to all three. I stayed up and I worked on for weeks and days and then down to the hours. And then that night before, I just stayed up the entire night. And that was before young people, before the computers. Yeah, you had to actually type that up and type it all up and all the applications and the essays and everything. And I had a stack of them and they're all in their envelopes and they have the stamps on them and everything. And in my mind's eye, it must have been at least 6 inches, you know, of envelopes of applications for graduate school programs across the country. And my mailman came, and that morning I was exhausted but exhilarated. I'd been up all night. Remember those all-nighters? And I was up all night, and I handed the mailman the stack, and I said, these are my applications for graduate school. I've been up all night. Thank you so much for taking them to mail them. And I handed him that stack, and he smiled and left, and I waited, as we all do, and I waited, and I waited. And after not hearing anything, not even an acknowledgement of receipt or saying I'm in, I'm out, and one of the programs I said, well, I think about law school and being a writer. So the University of Iowa has a very well-known writing program and a law school. So I applied to the University of Iowa writing program as well as their law school. And I thought, okay, I think I have a strategic plan here, and I waited. And then I realized after 3 months of not hearing anything, as the spring was opening and the end of the school year was coming, graduation was around the corner, I began to get very nervous. So I sat down and I had the list of places I had applied to, graduate programs around the country. You know, I was at the time, remember, should I be a writer? Should I go to business school? Should I go to law school? I wasn't sure. So I just began to call. And I called the University of Iowa. And I said, you know, I applied over 4 months ago, and I haven't heard anything. And they said, we don't have anything from you. And I thought that was kind of strange. And I contacted the other schools, and one by one, they all said we never received anything. And I was, of course, devastated because I realized that that smiling white mailman who had taken all my applications had thrown them away, never mailed them. And so the question becomes not what happens to you. Sometimes it comes down to how we respond to what happens to us. And I think it was not just being bused into schools in my middle school and high school days and being one of a handful of that in these classes. It wasn't just being at a college where we were not welcome, but I decided, even though we started as this very small handful of black students, only even just a fingerful actually graduated. But I think these elements of that denial of my goals by a so-called public servant, to intentionally do this and so many other things that have happened to me in my life made me the activist. So you may not think I want to be an activist. I don't think I really wanted to. I know I'm an overly protective person when it comes to certain people, especially the underdogs of the world, those who don't have the voice or don't have the wherewithal to use their voices. But that made me an activist. These things that I'd gone through little by little, you know, forced me to say, I've got to speak up. And there are many, many more things that have happened. But that was a turning point in my life. But I decided there was one school I had applied to that wasn't in that stack. I was accepted into that school and I attended that school. And that's how I came to then be in a situation in which being a writer as well as being an activist and being a civil rights attorney, all those things have been a part of my trajectory. But I also believe in a life that's spirit-led, that sometimes we have to say, I'm going to make the best of what I have. And there have been people along the line who have seen something in me, and my listeners have been part of that whole trajectory, that you saw something in me when I was just a guest on the show for Hugh Hamilton. Remember that? When I started off in the 2000s, I think it was 2007, that I was on his show as a guest. And then to go through everything that's happened for me to be where I am today, I could not have planned it. But those like Hugh Hamilton, who saw something in me, gave me my start in radio. And so when I say we use this power within our wingspan, where you are, what you are doing, there are things where you are right now today that could be helpful to others. And you may not know exactly how it's going to come out. The counselor at the college whom I didn't know that well at the time, and I said, I'm ready to graduate. I'm going. I'm leaving. I need to know how I can best navigate my way out of here, who decided to be helpful. And I had counselors who undermined my progress. I try to focus on those who have been helpful, but, you know, watch and pray. I also try to watch out for those who are there to undermine. And they are there as well, either jealousy or insecurity or this sense that we will not be replaced, or who are you? Who do you think you are? All those things come with the territory. And I know some people who have stopped their dreams out of fear that they would be disliked because they are ambitious, or disliked because of their ability to move forward, and they use their special talents that they've been given in a way that excels above whatever I might be able to do. Or, you know, if I could sing and I would, but I don't think you'd want to hear me sing. I think I have a great voice for me at home, but I don't know if anybody ever paid money for it or if I could ever make a living. But that doesn't mean you can't enjoy those things. My point is, we all have blessings, and we all have those who want to stand in the way of those blessings, and we all have the power to help those who are either struggling or trying to move forward in this world. And we can do so without harming ourselves in most cases, but just operate. When that comes before you, when you are standing there and you have a choice, I believe the choice should be one in which we try to do the right thing. Try to help out our fellow person, our sister in the cause. Try to be there for they, them. Try to make sure that if we have skills that others are paying us for during the day, that we can use those skills on the weekends as weekend warriors, or in the evenings, that we can have what was called midnight schools back in the day, hundreds of years ago, when people were forbidden from reading and writing. Those who knew a little bit more helped the others. That is how we go forward. You just do what you can with what you already have. Just share that, and it will be something miraculous. And it might not be for the person you deem it to be. Each one teach one, but not just the little cute one. not always just the well-behaved one. We have to make sure that we are helping those. And when we do as activists by acting, very simple, that we know that we are being a blessing to someone else. And as we go forward, just let us take along somebody else. And it may not be a relative. It may be a complete stranger. But all of us have a gift, and we need to share those gifts or they'll die with us. So I want us to talk about not just what is going on in the world, but how we might help a little bit. And by sharing that, we may be able to assist others through this phone call, through this radio station, through this podcast, through this time that we have together. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. So I'm trying to share, and I'm trying for the most part to share some item of Constitution, because I'm one of these Constitution geeks. And in sharing this with you, I want to be able to get you to see what is going on in the world from my perspective, from my body of knowledge, from what I can share. As I told you, if I could sing it, I would. I don't know if I should, but I want you to know about something that's going on with the U.S. Supreme Court that I think is undermining even its lowest time period of public concern. Here's the thing. The public polls have shown that the U.S. Supreme Court has its lowest standing, in our view, in general public, in the history of the Supreme Court that they've been taking polls. Its lowest standing. That the idea that the supermajority of conservatives bypassing all the rules before deciding through their confirmation hearings that they would pretty much lie and say that they would hold true certain precedents, that have now decided they have the votes. They don't care if it makes sense in their legal reasoning. If they're giving consistency to the country through their opinions, they just want to come together in the end and have what they consider to be the country that they want to design, a country that looks more like the 1940s and 50s than a country in the 21st century. And it's called this phrase, certiorari before judgment. Certiorari before judgment. Certiorari before judgment. So let's look at what certiorari is. And I spell that C-E-R-T-I-O-R-A-R-I. Certiorari. Some pronounce it certiorari, but certiorari is how I'm going to pronounce it today, because that's the way the majority of people do pronounce it. And certiorari is a request for review. When a case begins in court, whether or not it's state court or federal court, it begins at the trial court level. And so the trial court in every state is a court in which you have the judge and sometimes a jury. Unfortunately, because we have so many cases before our courts, most of these criminal cases, for example, are forced into plea bargains. And so the prosecutor will say, well, if you make me go to court on this, meaning make me actually allow you to have your constitutional rights to a jury, then I am going to throw all the charges at you. But if you take a plea deal, this plea bargain, then I will say to the judge that, oh, we're going to just work this out with one charge instead of five, even though there has to be proof that beyond a reasonable doubt this person, defendant, committed this crime. The prosecutor can say, well, we're just going to go for everything if you don't plead out. And so we have many people, we'll say 99% of criminal cases are plea bargained cases, because check this out. This is, I think, very important for us to understand. There are not enough judges, members of the jury, court personnel, and lawyers for even half of those people who have been charged with crimes and have cases before the court to actually go to trial. Do you hear me? In this country, the United States is the most litigious country in the world. We have more lawyers, more judges, more cases, and more laws on the books than any other country in the world. And yet at the same time, we don't have enough court personnel, enough judges, enough prosecutors, enough defense counsel, enough people who are going to be taken into the court system as potential jurors in order for people to have a trial. And so many people then have to plead out their cases, forced into plea bargainings, because one, that we don't have enough people to plead to actually have these cases go to trial, but the plea bargaining process then allows our system to continue to work. Because even if, and this is a strategy for people to think about, even if we had one-third of the people charged with crimes say, I want a jury trial, at the same time, we have laws that require that cases come to court within a certain time period. The Speedy Trial Act requires that people can are put for the court and not languish in waiting for their trials to take place, or languish because they cannot afford bail. All these things are going on at the same time. So just to give you an idea of all of that that's going on, and then when a case does go to verdict, that verdict can be appealed. And in federal court, the verdict is appealed from the district court to the Court of Appeals. And then from the Court of Appeals, for that case to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, there has to be a request for review, or a writ, W-R-I-T, of certiorari, a request. Certiorari, we said, is a request for the court to review the lower court's findings and determination, and then for the U.S. Supreme Court to make a decision to take that case up on appeal, to have it as part of its docket. And then for the 10,000 requests for review, yes, 10,000 per year, writ of certiorari, there are 10,000 writs presented to the court, presented asking for review. And of those 10,000 requests for certiorari, requests for review, the court might take about 200 to 300 cases per year. So this is the process going forward from state courts, from the trial court level going up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and then from the federal courts. What we have now in this supermajority of this conservative court is certiorari before judgment, which means that the U.S. Supreme Court is allowing certain cases to jump over the hoops. And these cases are then taken by the U.S. Supreme Court as the supermajority decides that it wants to then create a docket based on the cases it's choosing, and not even allowing the case to have its determination by the appellate courts. That is what's going on. So instead of going up to the court in the proper manner, we've had dozens of cases with this new supermajority jumping over the hoops of established protocol and process and taking cases before there's been a judgment, certiorari before judgment, and then deciding those cases in ways in which we don't know how these cases are decided, because the end result is handed to us without any other, without any oral argument, without all the due process of the briefing. The case is then decided by the supermajority, and that then becomes the law of the land. This is a concern. This is a fear. This is a discussion that's taking place within circles, with those who watch the Supreme Court, those who are constitutional law geeks, who are saying that this is unprecedented, the number of cases that are going before the supermajority and being decided by the supermajority. When I say supermajority, I mean that it takes five people on the Supreme Court to create the law of the land, five out of the nine. But what we have here, we have six conservatives on the court, and so that's why it's called a supermajority. This is something I wanted to bring to you, and these cases become the cases that run our lives. At 10 o'clock today, United States versus Texas will be heard. You can go to the U.S. Supreme Court website and find the recordings of the oral arguments. And this issue, one of these issues that will be before the court, will be one that speaks to this issue of certiorari before judgment and the supermajority being able to take these cases before judgment and judgment by the Court of Appeals, judgment by the highest court that's allowed to give judgment before the court is then before the Court of Appeals then gives its judgment, and then the case and can be properly before the U.S. Supreme Court on a writ of certiorari. This is taking place so that we're bypassing whatever the structures are that are put in place, the checks and balances we have within our branches of government, and in particular within this branch. That's a concern I have. That's what's going on. And I have looked at it as a concern, and I wanted you to know more about it. And because of that, that's kind of the way in which we are going forward with our Supreme Court. And it's a scary time because we thought our Supreme Court would be that one branch of government that would be reliable. But for the majority of the court's history, it's been more of a tool of oppression than a weapon for liberation. We know those bright spots that have come out like Brown v. Board of Education and others, but those bright spots come like a star and then they linger and we see the light left over from that supernova that created the star. But that once-in-a-lifetime, here-and-there Brown case is not the overall history of our U.S. Supreme Court. The overall history of our U.S. Supreme Court has been more in which people have had, unfortunately, more of a sense of oppression by the court where it is continuing to establish dominance by certain people. And those Obergefell cases, for example, that granted same-sex marriage, the Roe versus Wade cases, those cases are cases that are the bright lights that have come that speak to not just where the country was at the time, but also the rights of people who are in minority positions, because the court has to speak for more than just the majority. If the majority won every time, then, you know, women would not be in positions of power. People of color would be in subservient positions around the country worse than they are right now. And religious groups would be marginalized and terrorized. So in order for that not to be the way the country is on a full-time basis, we've had a court have bright spots, but I think that the supermajority is one that wants to take us back in which we had a patriarchy that was white male dominated from a conservative standpoint. And I don't say that all white males are conservative. I'm not saying that. But from the standpoint of who should be the voice of this country, who should be making the rules, who should be determining the values of this country. And sometimes when people say, well, you know, why not have it be white male values of conservative kind in which women take a secondary place and people of color are getting crumbs from the table of justice? Why not have that? Well, why would that be necessary if the people who are in positions of power, those who believe they are there naturally, then naturally they would have to stay and not by subjugation of others through violence and discriminatory laws. Naturally, if they are superior in some way through physical or intellectual ability, then naturally they would be in positions of superiority. They wouldn't need to use our court system to incarcerate 2 million people each year, breaking up families and communities, preventing people from going forward with the best of their qualities, the best of their blessings, the best of their talents. They wouldn't need to throw away the graduate school applications from some little black child who's just trying to use her intellect and be a positive part of a community. You wouldn't need to do that if you believed you were indeed naturally superior. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. We'll be right back with your insights after this musical break.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson, we miss you, and that was I'll Be There. Yes, just look over your shoulder, and I'll Be There. And this is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. We're on the air for you, WBAI listeners. So become a BAI buddy. Become my buddy, please. And so we have our first guest on. Good morning. Yes, good morning. I can't hear you. I can't hear you for some reason. Okay. So we have our next caller on. You're on Law of the Land. Good morning.
Good morning, Gloria. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, beautiful. It was very interesting, your introduction of the complexity of the criminal justice system, and the defendant does not have an edge. I would just like to suggest a concept, a thought. I know you're familiar with it, but as I give it to you, I would like to see how you would expound on it. You know, in the whole legal system, you're arrested, they put you in jail, then you go in front of a court, and then they tell you, how do you plead to the indictment? I think if you say not guilty, the next step is to set a date for trial. My strategy, and I'm suggesting it to you, and maybe you could expound on it, there's a term, there's a word, and I'm going to spell it for you. When the clerk of the court asks the defendant, how do you plead to the indictment? The only time in the whole process of the criminal justice system you can actually stop the wheels of justice, a defendant, all he has to say is, I demur to the indictment. Demur. D-E-M-U-R-R-E-R, which legally states that you believe, the defendant believes, that the evidence or information that was used to create the indictment was insufficient. Therefore, they would have to set a hearing aside. No judge could say, well, I'm going to plead for you. And I'm just going to hang up and allow you to expound on that word. D-E-M-U-R-R-E-R. Every defendant has that right. Okay. Love you, and your program is beautiful.
Okay, so we have been given this, we demur to the indictment. And what I found, in a criminal case, a demur is a defendant's assertion that the document laying out the charges, a complaint, information, or indictment is legally insufficient. In demurring, the defendant claims that the charging document is so flawed that it can't be used to convict him or her. So if someone wanted to make these statements, they could, and then there would be the judge who would say, we find this sufficient, and we'll have a legal standard that sets out what is considered a sufficient indictment. And so a sufficient indictment is supposed to have certain corners to it, or certain elements that must be met in order for an indictment to be sufficient. And so I think that in the end, the objection would be one in which it would be noted for the record. Once that has been noted, the process is pretty swift to decide whether or not the indictment itself is sufficient. But I think it is something that could be noted for the record. And in noting it for the record, setting out what makes this indictment insufficient. So I also would want to know if this was something that was a strategy. It could be a stalling tactic, but I don't think it would result in the case not going forward at all. But I do think that what most defense counsel will look at is whether or not there is something that is in this strategy that would not, one, just irritate the judge and make the judge against this particular defendant in the beginning of the trial, and therefore look at it as a stalling tactic and not as a tactic that is meant to have a substantive basis for it, but also I still believe that defense counsel and people who are trying to bring these cases and trying to figure out what types of cases one could have that would bring to the general public the insufficiencies, prejudices, racism, and flaws within our criminal justice system, that I think there needs to be an overarching strategy for that. We could do piecemeal places and arguments and piecemeal practices, but in the end, what is the overarching strategy of those who know our criminal justice system is based in racially induced flaws that is, and that this system is undermining communities, millions of people across the country? What is the strategy? And it has to be one, and I believe, that includes protest as well as litigation and legislation. So that trifecta of litigation, legislation, and protest with a vision going forward, what is the vision for reconstructing or deconstructing our criminal justice system, because it is completely flawed? And we could try little tactics here and there in individual cases, but what is the overarching strategy? The overarching strategy to do something about this criminal justice system. And I'm going to give you an instance that took place. Some of you may know that I was a fellow at Harvard University, at the Harvard Kennedy School. And that's the school for government. I was also there as a visiting professor. So I was teaching one of the core public policy courses at the Harvard Kennedy School, as well as a fellow in the Institute of Politics at the Harvard Kennedy School. And my fellowship there is nearing an end. And so what I found was that there are amazing things taking place at Harvard. People from all over the world come to Harvard to be a part of that educational philosophy, that environment, all of that, you know, and it still has some major issues too. As Malcolm X said that Harvard messed up more black people than liquor, I can see that too when I was there. But here's the thing that I was concerned about. We have people who come to Harvard to be a part of what's called a forum. And they are there. And these forums, actually, if you have a chance, they are on YouTube. So you can find them, or you can look at forums and at Harvard University, at the Kennedy School, and you'll find them recorded. There's one in particular that speaks to what the caller has said, and this speaks to in a different way, and I just want to put this forward. Liz Cheney, former U.S. Senator, Republican from Wyoming, Liz Cheney, was a speaker at the Harvard Kennedy School at one of the forums. And so after she had spoken and everybody congratulated her for being a part of the January 6th proceeding and putting her political life on the line and losing her election because of that, she went up for re-election, and losing that primary, I asked the question, so what are you now saying to other Republicans regarding the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill? Because the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill, if you're saying that the democracy is in peril and all of these, you know, Republicans and Democrats, the democracy, our democracy is in peril, it's in peril. It's like, okay, so basic voting rights should be part of your discussion. You should want to support the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill. So, and she said in front of everyone, you can go back and see the video of this. She said, no, I voted against the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill. And she believes, and she said, that the federal government should not be involved in voting rights. She said this. You can go find it. I asked the question. This is what came out of her mouth that she said, and you can go watch me ask the question and watch her answer it. Look for Liz Cheney, Harvard Kennedy School. So what I'm saying is, if we have federal legislation, and we do, for many different things, we have federal legislation with the George Floyd bill, and at the same time, and that federal legislation for the George Floyd bill is to hopefully reform, change the way our criminal justice system that began as bounty hunters during the time period of enslavement as militia meant to destroy the families of Native Americans and take their land. To put down Native American uprisings, all of these ways in which our criminal justice system began, rose up, and now continues to be infested with the racism of hundreds of years. We need federal legislation, we need protest, and we need litigation, all those things to work. And so we can have a strategy in which people decide that they're not going to plea out. They're not going to plead. They're going to not take a plea bargain. They're going to actually go to court. But we need to have this in some strategic form across the country that will, in a way, say we're not going to allow our criminal justice system to go forward as is. We could have this demur to the indictment. We could have this, but it has to be part of a strategy that has a larger vision to it. Because we have people who are saying, from their standpoint, our democracy is in jeopardy. But we're in the shadows saying we don't even have basic voting rights over here. We have those people who could say, yes, we want to make differences when it comes to how our police operate. But then we're saying over 1,000 people are dying at the hands of police every year. And unless we go burn something down, you don't pay attention. We need to have people who are supposed to be speaking for us in these positions of power, the black elite, the this, that, and the other, all these people. When do we ever come together with a strategy, and when is it more action-based strategy that we can all participate in, because we regular people would participate in the strategy to the best of our ability if we knew what the heck it was. But at this point, we don't have these so-called people out here with a strategy they're willing to tell us about. They're in some corner somewhere in their own meetings, having their own discussions, getting great sums of grant money to do what they do to keep their organizations going, and never say a word to us. And this has been going on for years. So we need to start calling out some of these organizations that are supposedly operating on our behalf, but never come and tell us what the heck they're doing and how we can participate in it. So that, my listener, is my response to your call. And we're going to take one more musical break. And if you have something you'd like to put forward regarding our criminal justice system, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. We'll be right back after this musical break with our listeners' comments. And this is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. The Whispers, and I actually like The Whispers very, very much, and Miss Scotty. So that was How Long. This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall on WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. And whether you are here in the tri-state area, around the country, or around the world, I say thank you for listening to Law of the Land. We have a listener right now on the air. Good morning. Good morning.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Good morning.
Yeah, Matum from New Jersey. First and foremost, shout-outs to the political prisoners in the United States, Mateen Abdur Mateen Durham in New Jersey, Suniata Okoli in New Jersey, Momia Abu-Jamal in Pennsylvania, Matula Shakur in New York, Jameel Alameen in Alabama. And even though the Native Americans don't do a lot of advocating for us on their free channel TV show, Leonard Peltier. So I wanted to ask a couple questions, and you might want to answer them off the, you know, when I get off, you know. But is there any way that our legal minds could have designed a way so that the African-American, indigenous African-Americans, descendants of African slaves in the United States, not the black diaspora, Caribbean, Africa, all that, those who were slaves of the U.S. government could have been designated as a protected class a long time ago, so that when it comes to holding office, like Gandhi did, and I'm not no fan of Gandhi, we would not have to run against those who have long experiences in politics, knowing how government works, all of that. The other thing is, what is it about appointing judges in the state of New Jersey that they think that that's some kind of positive thing? Thousands and thousands of judges that the public never sees unless they're in their courtroom losing something most of the time. Do you even see these people? And other states, PA, New York, you elect people. You get to see their face before they come up to you talking about, I'm taking your license, I'm taking your car, your house, I'm taking your freedom. And sometimes even your life, and you never seen this joker a day in your life. You might have seen him sitting in the strip club, but you didn't even know who he was. And the last thing, why does the U.S. Constitution not say that you have to be a lawyer to sit on the United States Supreme Court and possibly other federal courts? It may be there, but I didn't see it. Do you have to be, and are there people in New York that are judges that aren't lawyers?
Okay, well, let me start with the last question first, because you touched on a lot of great points. One, the U.S. Constitution does not state that a person must be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court. You are correct. That is not in the Constitution. And so most places, it's assumed that the person is going to have a law background, but it does not state it in the U.S. Constitution that one must be a lawyer to be a justice of the high court. And I knew of a judge in Philadelphia who was in traffic court who was not a lawyer. And he was a judge in traffic court. And so, yes, there are judges who are sitting in states today, and they could be sitting in states where local jurisdictions will allow them to be a judge and not be a lawyer. Or if they're running for the position, lawyers would probably say, well, I would make a better candidate. I would make a better judge for this position because of the law background. But that doesn't mean that the person they're running against might not be, you know, someone who will say they have more information or they have a better background. So, yes, you're right about that. There is nothing in the Constitution that says that a judge must be a lawyer, but there could be local laws that say that judges must be lawyers, or the tradition is such that it's very difficult for some non-lawyer to gain a position as a local judge or magistrate. Going back to judges in general, I am so glad you mentioned this. I think that we as a community, and this is we writ large, we meaning the tri-state area, the national landscape, needs to pay more attention to the judges who are running for office. We have looked at other offices. We've looked at other politicians. We've focused on those who are running for positions in our legislative bodies statewide, or are running for Congress, running for president. We have not focused on the judges, and we need to do that. So thank you, my brother, for bringing that up. That has been something I've wanted to talk about for some time. I was going to do a whole show on it, and I might do that in the future, but this is a good front runner for that, that we need to focus on who is running for judges for the position of being a judge who will adjudicate these issues from family court to criminal justice, appellate courts. These positions of power are such that they can wreak havoc in the lives of our communities. And as we know before, you know, all kinfolk ain't skinfolk, all skinfolk ain't kinfolk. We need to understand the positions of these people, and not just that they have been approved by a political body, but are they approved by the body community? And have they shown some disrespect towards people of different groups that they would not be the best to be in those positions? Or have they shown while they've been in those positions that they have a disdain for the community? I know my brother Manuel Gomez, who has been on this program many times, has called out a number of judges in the boroughs of New York, as well as some in New Jersey, who have shown disdain for the legal system. He's shown from judges in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania disdain for people in positions of before them wanting justice and receiving racism. So we need to focus on those judges. Thank you so very much for bringing that to the attention of the listeners and really focusing my attention on it, because I needed that for something that I've been wanting to do for a while. The first point that you raised, and now the last point I'll get to, African Americans as a protected class. It is something very interesting. I remember when President Obama ran for office and was then elected the first African American president, that people from the Caribbean said, why are you making such a big deal about this? We've had black presidents for quite some time, and this is a big deal for you. And you're right. There's a difference when people have been intentionally by law and violence prevented from fully realizing their political power. And then starting in the 1960s, even though we were in politics earlier than that, from the 1870 when we had our first black U.S. senators and U.S. Congress people and House representatives and local politics as well, that we're in a situation in which we are playing catch up. We've done very well pushing forward, but other people do have a better sense of how politics work. But it would have been good to have us as a protected class. It was thought that way, but I don't think it was assumed that other people from other parts of the African diaspora would come in and not work with the African American community, or see the African American community in such disparaging terms that they believed that from the outside that we just didn't take advantage of the opportunities here in this country, and that should be pushed to the side and let other people come in and take advantage of these opportunities. So that is a major concern. And there's so much I'd like to say about that, but I'm out of my time for this show this day. And I am just so pleased, as I always say, I have the smartest listeners. And thank you so much for supporting Law of the Land. And I want you to know that I think about you even when you might not be thinking about me. Yes, because I think about what is it my listeners need to know. So as we go forward, I want you to say, please be an activist in your own way, to yourselves and maybe to a friend or two. And until then, thank you, Michael G. I'll see you on the radio.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Gloria is the author of She Took Justice, The Black Woman, Law, and Power.
It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm fierce.
Las cosas pasan rápido en la calle. Su velocidad le puede parecer lenta al manejar, pero si atropella a alguien, es espantosamente rápida. Conductores, estén pendientes de los peatones y ciclistas, y al doblar, reduzcan la velocidad a 5 millas por hora. El exceso de velocidad arruina vidas. Reduzca la velocidad. Un mensaje de la iniciativa Vision Zero de la ciudad de Nueva York.
Hey, this is Chaka Khan. Hey, this is Chaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
All right, thank you very much for that, Chaka Khan. Here over listener-sponsored, commercial-free radio WBAI in New York at 99.